It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, October 9. I'm Phil Picardi. From the handling of abusive priests to the impacts of the government shutdown to protests outside the Ordway, it's a jammed podcast. So without further ado, let's go. Two former employees of the Twin Cities Archdiocese have exposed extra payments to priests accused of child sexual abuse and other misconduct. A former accounting director, now sentenced to prison for stealing, says he cut the secret checks. And a former canon lawyer says she blew the whistle to try to stop those payments. Madeline Barron has the story.
He was known as the Polka Padre.
I've got a never-ending love for you. From now on, that's all I want to do.
Robert Capone was ordained a priest in the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis in 1964 and served in seven parishes. Capone played his accordion and performed what he called polka masses at churches throughout the Twin Cities. The Polka Padre later became known in the media as the Polka Predator when young men came forward in the late 80s and early 90s to sue Capone and the Archdiocese for sexual abuse they say they suffered as children. Five brought civil lawsuits, but it was too late for criminal charges. 28-year-old Dale Scheffler refused to settle. His case went to a 10-day trial in Hennepin County in 1996. Scheffler says Capone took him on an overnight trip to the priest's cabin when he was 13 years old and sexually assaulted him in the lake and while he was sleeping. Capone testified that while he had abused some boys, he was not attracted to Scheffler. The trial became a showdown between victims of child sexual abuse and the church. Victims' attorney Jeff Anderson revealed top church leaders knew of Capone's sexual abuse and did nothing. An attorney for the Archdiocese tried to convince jurors that Scheffler was confused and suggested some of his trauma may have come not from abuse, but from his father's struggle with arthritis. Capone was still a pastor as the case went to trial. Outside the courtroom, Scheffler begged then-Archbishop Harry Flynn to take Capone and other abusive priests out of ministry.
I come here today to ask you to please remove him. How can you go on living and knowing that they're doing this? Please, I'm asking you to remove these people, to remove all these priests that are doing this, to these kids that are getting hurt.
Later that day, Flynn removed Capone from his parish, but stood by his claim of innocence. The jury awarded Scheffler $1 million verdict, but Scheffler never saw a dime. The case was overturned because a higher court decided the statute of limitations had run out. The Archdiocese billed Scheffler for legal expenses, though it never collected. Capone wound up with a very comfortable life. An NPR News investigation has found that the Archdiocese allowed Capone to take medical retirement and gave him an extra $957 a month above and beyond his pension. Those extra payments from 1998 to 2012 added up to more than $160,000. Former Archdiocese canon lawyer Jennifer Hasselberger learned of the secret payments to Capone and others during an audit last year.
So what we were providing to Capone was in excess of what we were providing to those many priests who have done nothing but well by the faithful of this archdiocese.
In other dioceses where Hasselberger worked, a priest like Capone would likely have been defrocked. Some dioceses elsewhere have built secure facilities to house elderly offenders. The Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis puts offending priests on a monitoring program. It wasn't until 2004, 8 years after Capone's trial, that any officials from the Archdiocese went to Capone's home to check on him. Hasselberger describes seeing a memo written by then Vicar General Kevin McDonough, assuring Archbishop Harry Flynn that Capone was exceptionally well provided for, well beyond what was required under canon law. McDonough detailed the stunningly beautiful lake home that Capone had inherited from his parents, with its 600 feet of waterfront. Capone still lives on this property in Cold Spring and winters in Florida. The $500,000 home is secluded. It's one of the places where Capone abused young boys. On a recent afternoon, Capone was taking care of some yard work. He jumped off the lawnmower to answer a few questions.
What can I do for you?
He's a trim 74-year-old with a full head of white hair and dark sunglasses. Because of his history of abuse, Capone is supposed to be carefully monitored. I asked him about it.
Do you have any contact with the Archdiocese still?
About once a month.
Okay. So does someone come visit you, or how does that work?
Well, not really. We just get together, you know, at different times.
So is it who? So it's someone.
But I just meet with a priest that I want to up here or wherever.
Is it that monitoring program?
No.
Okay. So it's just someone you meet with for.
I just discuss, you know, news and happenings in the world and so on.
At his trial, Capone offered testimony about what he described as a 13-year struggle with sexual compulsions toward young boys. He claimed to have been cured by God, and former Archbishop John Roach described it as almost a miracle. Capone now says the allegations that he abused boys were exaggerated.
It's a difficult thing to explain, you know. I just don't care to get into that. That's all past.
But if someone were to say that you did it, would you say, no, that's not true?
Some of it.
Capone is still a priest, but he isn't allowed to serve as a pastor. He says he lives alone and no longer has contact with children.
Any regrets at all about your time as a priest?
No, not at all. No. No. I felt I was called by God, and I believe I served him well.
Do you think about those days very often?
No, I don't. No, no. I'm very, very happy, and I'm a classical pianist, and just enjoy it. I go out to lunch in town and come back and pray.
Capone still receives his pension, but the extra payments of nearly $1,000 a month were cut off after Hasselberger, the canon lawyer, discovered them.
Capone is supposed to be living a life of prayer and penance. And I still cannot reconcile how a man who's supposed to be doing penance for the egregious sins that he committed, not to mention the crimes, but just the egregious sins, is vacationing in Venice, Florida, and living in a stunningly beautiful lake home, the actual site of all of these, of many of these acts of abuse.
Hasselberger resigned in April. She says she wanted to come forward about the payments because she thinks they're immoral, but she knows the news will be painful for victims.
Well, I'm very sorry that they have to learn about that. I'm very sorry that it's true.
It makes you sick to your stomach.
Dale Scheffler, the man who sued Capone and lost, is now 46.
Why would he get paid extra? I mean, crying out loud, the guy was doing all these things to kids and stuff like that and just getting away with it, and now they're paying him extra. Why are they paying him extra?
That question would also arise at the Chancery, and Scott Domeyer, the former director of accounting who cut the checks, says the answer was always that as long as these men remained priests, they had to be taken care of. He also thinks the payments allowed the archdiocese to retain some measure of control over the men. Domeyer is now serving a 3-year prison term for theft and tax evasion. It was in the wake of his departure that auditors were brought in and Hasselberger learned of the secret money. She composed a detailed memo to Archbishop John Nienstedt, informing him of what she'd found. Nienstedt responded, saying this was the first he'd heard of it. But Domeyer says the archbishop signed off on the payments every year, though the priests were not listed by name.
Over the years, when we would do our budgets, of course, the pot of funds or the department that all these payments were being charged to, I would be describing to the archbishop, whichever Nienstedt and Flynn, the purpose of why some of these dollar amounts are in there. These are for the priests that we are carrying because of misconduct either with minors or adults.
The archbishop did not respond to an interview request, but a statement from the archdiocese said, quote, to help ensure that the offending priest does not reoffend, he must have financial, therapeutic, and spiritual support. The archdiocese has sought to provide that support where necessary, end quote. McDonough argued in 1997 that Capone needed the money for legal bills, and it was important for the church that he be well represented. 17 years ago, at Capone's trial, attorney Jeff Anderson asked jurors to deliver a verdict against the archdiocese that would, as he put it, strike the bell and deliver the blow that will be heard and felt, a lesson learned that will never be forgotten. Anderson says the payments to Capone now show the church learned nothing.
He was a multiple offender that abused many kids. It was tried to a jury who came back and rendered a verdict finding that the top officials had engaged in a willful and intentional disregard for the safety of Dale and other kids in the Archdiocese, and to continue to pay him and continue to give him safe harbor and support after that is just shockingly craven.
While Capone's extra checks were cut off, payments to others continued. Domeyer says payments to priests involved in misconduct cost the Archdiocese roughly $250,000 a year. The Archdiocese has recently announced the formation of a new task force to review archdiocesan policy on clergy sexual abuse of minors and other misconduct.
That's Madeline Barron. St. Paul police have reopened an investigation into whether a Twin Cities priest had child pornography on his computer. Less than a week ago, police said they were closing the case because of insufficient evidence. Here's Tom Scheck.
St. Paul police spokesman Howie Padilla says the circumstances involving Father John Shelley changed as a result of new information brought forward to police. He said multiple pieces of information, including the action by a Hugo citizen, prompted them to reopen the case.
Within the last several days, we had garnered several pieces of new information, and as we had stated when this information began trickling in, we would look at that information. We would examine it for its evidentiary value and see whether, in fact, there was more follow-up that needed to be done and whether an investigation had to be reopened or a new one begun. Today, we decided it is imperative for us to reopen the investigation.
One of the reasons police are reopening the case is that Joe Ternus of Hugo provided the police with additional information. Ternus's family initially found the pornography on Shelley's computer in 2004 when they acquired it to use for their children. He contacted the Archdiocese, which confiscated the computer and kept the information secret for 8 years. When NPR News contacted Ternus last week about the computer, he said he remembered that he made a copy of some of Shelley's files and then turned the computer disk over to police. He said today he's pleased the information prompted police to take another look.
If there's something on there that's actionable, I'm glad that it got into the right hands, and I hope that they can pursue it to the correct end this time.
The case surrounding Shelley was closed last week after police said they had insufficient evidence to move forward. But the police investigator said in his report that he wasn't sure if he received the original discs or copies, and he would probably never know. An NPR News investigation also revealed that a consultant hired by the Archdiocese audited Shelley's computer files and found 2,300 pornographic images, including some they described as borderline illegal because they depicted youthful-looking males. The investigation also found that Archbishop Neinstedt and others debated whether police should be contacted. They never took that step. Jennifer Hasselberger, who served as Neinstedt's canon lawyer in the Archdiocese, contacted police about the files earlier this year. She resigned her position in April. Padilla, with the St. Paul Police, was careful to say that reopening the case doesn't mean Shelley or officials at the Archdiocese will be charged with a crime. But he was also careful to say the investigation could go beyond the initial child pornography investigation.
As is the case with any investigation, we have new information now, and we're going to follow the track that new information takes us to. If that new information takes us to the track of other allegations or other possible criminal activity, we'll follow that to its end.
While it may be surprising that a case of this magnitude is reopened, law professor Eileen Scallon says it's not unusual. Scallon, who left William Mitchell to become an associate dean at UCLA, says the fact that the case involves the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis plays a factor into the decision.
There's a very, very strong public interest here in making sure that there has been no effort to cover up or protect someone who has involvement in the Archdiocese. And so I think that does factor in.
A spokesman for the Archdiocese issued a statement saying they will cooperate fully with any investigation, as they have since the outset. An attorney for Shelley declined to comment.
That's Tom Scheck for us on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Former Republican Senator Rod Grams has died. Grams struggled with cancer. Family spokesman Kent Kaiser says Grams died last night at his home north of the Twin Cities.
He had entered home hospice some time ago, and he passed away last evening, 11:45, at home near Crown. with his wife at his side.
Graham served one term in the U.S. House and one term in the Senate in the 1990s. He is being remembered as a principled, humble conservative. Many Minnesotans first came to know him through his job as a TV news anchorman at KMSP-TV in the Twin Cities. Kaiser says a public funeral is being planned. A man who was severely beaten on the east side of St. Paul is talking about his recovery. Ray Widstrand was walking near his apartment when he was attacked. Five people, including four juveniles, have been charged. Authorities say the attackers were among dozens of young people engaged in a street brawl when Widstrand tried to pass on his way home. Matt Sepik spoke with Widstrand, who's undergoing therapy at the Courage Center in Golden Valley.
Ray Widstrand remembers nothing of what happened to him on August 4th. His memory of his life since then starts several days later.
I woke up in the hospital. I had my family surrounding me, and they were very supportive of me.
Part of Widstrand's skull had to be removed because of swelling, and he wears a helmet to protect his brain. Because of his head injury, the right side of Widstrand's body is weaker than his left side, and he says relearning basic body motions is a challenge beyond words.
Having those muscle groups and connections that don't exist between the brain and the extremities anymore. I can't seem to make anybody understand how difficult that is, but I try, and it's cool having all the support I do. Something I learned living with my family, that is to maintain a positive mental attitude at all times.
Is that a hard thing to do?
No. I've always been a positive person. And even when it's dark, there's a dawn ahead.
To take you back to that horrible day in August, why do you think you were attacked? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. I approached my attackers. Maybe that was my mistake, but I feel like on a public street in broad daylight, you should be safe around your own home. And I wasn't, unfortunately.
Is there anything that you want to say to them?
No, there isn't, other than I'm healing. And I'll be out before anyone is ready for me to be out. And I can't help but feel sorry for those people who did this to me.
Are you ready to forgive them, or have you forgiven them?
I already have. I don't think my family is. Because they have to sit back and watch me come to and try to be normal again. They're the ones who are suffering. Because they're on the sidelines watching me stumble and fall and get back up again. Meanwhile, I am in control.
After another month of therapy, Widstrand will undergo surgery to replace the section of skull doctors removed after the attack. He says his goal is to be out of the Courage Center and back at his job at a suburban cable TV company by mid-December.
Look out at the Christmas party, because I'm going to be showing up.
Ray Widstrand with Matt Sepik. A weekend of the federal government shutdown, 148 more federal employees in Minnesota were furloughed yesterday. Some union workers marked the day with a round of informational picketing outside a federal office building in Minneapolis. Mark Zedeklik reports.
There were almost as many reporters and photographers on a sidewalk outside the Whipple Federal Building in South Minneapolis as there were picketers. The picketers carried homemade signs and offered up chants. Among them was 54-year-old Jeff Burke, who, absent the shutdown, would have been inside the Whipple building processing veterans' debt waiver claims.
I was furloughed today.
According to union leaders, Burke was sent home along with 147 co-workers who also process various veterans' claims. Burke's wife was furloughed too. The Burks and their two high school-age kids have gone from a two-income to a no-income family.
We're cutting our phone. And honest to God, we cut our newspaper service. I live from paycheck to paycheck. I have a mortgage to pay. I have children to support. I have a family. Now I'm looking for everything that I can cut possibly.
Burke and his wife and other furloughed workers are being told they'll get paid when the shutdown ends. Jeff Burke says he'll believe that when he sees it. He has no time for rhetoric about federal workers having no reason to complain because they're essentially on a paid vacation.
You know, everybody thinks all those government employees are going to get paid. They don't understand the stress and the things that it puts us through.
The workers hope demonstrations like today's and one yesterday in downtown Minneapolis
put us back to work.
Will pressure House Republican Speaker John Boehner into bringing up a resolution to fund the government that does not include conditions, such as defunding or delaying the Affordable Care Act. Union leader Vicky Sarovi organized today's demonstration. At yesterday's rally, she called on more people to call Congress.
Because when you don't make that phone call, they don't think it's important. When someone asked me where your paycheck coming from and what am I doing as a union president, I said, did you call your representative today? Did you tell them that we don't want to be shut down?
Also at both of this week's End the Shutdown gatherings was Denise Welty, who lives in Rochester. Her daughter and son-in-law are both working in federal corrections facilities without pay.
This is a hardship on families. Most young families live paycheck to paycheck, and now they don't even know when that paycheck's going to be.
Welty thinks support for ending the shutdown is building among the American people. She says everyone is affected by the furloughs and mandated work without pay.
When people aren't being paid, they're not shopping. They're not going out to eat. They're not visiting their local businesses. You know, it hurts everybody as a whole.
Stanley Walton is another one of the 148 people furloughed from the Veterans Service Center.
Well, I think I'm going to be fine for a while.
But for others, Walton says that's not the case. He says some people he knows who are furloughed have already been turning to their extended family members to try to borrow money.
My biggest concern is some other people that are lower pay scale than I am didn't have an opportunity to save money. So they are really going to be hurting pretty bad.
I went to see the speaker.
Went to see the speaker.
And all that he gave me.
All that he gave me.
Was a lousy furlough.
Was a lousy furlough.
Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison was arrested in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Brett Neely reports.
The federal government is shut down. Congress is deadlocked, and for a while on Tuesday, Representative Keith Ellison was locked up, but not because of the fiscal fight on Capitol Hill. The four-term Democrat was part of a rally on the National Mall to urge Congress to vote for an overhaul of the nation's immigration laws. Ellison was one of seven lawmakers who were arrested by U.S. Capitol Police for blocking a street. Ellison's office said he wasn't immediately available for an interview because he was still at a police processing facility. This isn't Ellison's first brush with civil disobedience. He was arrested in 2009 in front of the Sudanese embassy while protesting that country's policies in Darfur. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The family of a 9-year-old who stowed away on a flight to Las Vegas say they have tried to get help for the boy. Our Tim Nelson has more.
Authorities confirmed the boy that made headlines sneaking onto a Delta Airlines flight was the same one taken from the cab of a stolen truck in Minneapolis after smashing into several vehicles as police followed. V.J. Smith, a minister and president of Mad Dads, a youth service organization in Minneapolis, says he's talked to the boy's family. He says they've asked authorities for help before.
The family has had, issues with their son's behavior, and they've reached out for help in a number of ways. And so they were told that until a situation gets bad enough that they can't be helped by certain agencies. And so we feel that now the situation's hopefully got bad enough that we can get the help we need.
Smith says the boy is expected to be returned from Las Vegas to Minneapolis as early as today. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis is one of three finalist cities to host the 2018 Super Bowl. New Orleans and Indianapolis were also invited by the league to submit final applications. News of the announcement on the league's website lists Minneapolis as a favorite. Team Vice President Lester Bagley says that doesn't guarantee the NFL will choose the new stadium in Minneapolis.
It's also stiff competition because Indianapolis did a great job by all accounts, and it's always a good event in New Orleans, so we've got to deliver. But we have what it takes with a new venue that's going to be second to none in terms of fan experience, and our seats and premium spaces will be closer to the action than any other NFL stadiums.
The league expects to announce its choice in May. Hundreds of protesters showed up for the opening of Miss Saigon last night at the Ordway in St. Paul. Critics say the musical romanticizes prostitution and perpetuates negative stereotypes of Asians. Protester Kim Park Nelson.
You know, we've heard about a return of Miss Saigon to Broadway. We've heard about a Broadway traveling show, and we've heard about the possibility of a film. And so I think what's happening here tonight is probably like the first chapter in many, many painful chapters to come as Miss Saigon continues to be popular and successful.
Twee Smith was not among the protesters. She's the daughter of a Vietnamese woman and an American GI.
One of the arguments was they're worried about how Vietnamese men were portrayed in Vietnam as being the villain. Well, I'm sorry. A lot of them were like that during the war and capitalized on their own people, too.
Miss Saigon runs through the 13th at the Ordway. High heels serve as canvases in a new exhibit at Obsidian Arts in Minneapolis. Nikki Tundell profiles the community art project A Mile in My Shoes.
The way artist Esther Osiende sees it, everyone has a story worth sharing.
They might not want to talk about it verbally, but they would like to be able to express it in some form.
On this evening, that form is footwear. 17 women fill the carriage house of the Minnesota African American Museum and Cultural Center in Minneapolis. Osiende hands each a plain white shoe, molded from plaster. The Twin Cities painter, writer, and community leader is heading up a project called A Mile in My Shoes. Its goal is to showcase biographies of local Black women. But instead of documenting their ups and downs via pen and paper, participants use paint and glitter and all kinds of art supplies to transform those plaster shoes into personal profiles.
Yeah, there you go.
Osiende shares her own creation.
The heel on my shoe is dark and it has teardrops and it just represents the undercurrents, the transitions of things that I went through.
We got some purple glitter, we got some purple flowers.
It's about telling your story without telling me. You're working with images here. And when you work with images, you can be very, very safe. And sometimes that alone right there actually will give that person just a feeling of relief, I think, getting something out of them that maybe that's been stored up inside of them for years.
That's right. That's the heel. Yeah. Without the heel, you don't have it, baby.
The heel of Nancy Lee's shoe is encrusted with gold glitter. Black paint takes over where the shimmer ends.
Started out as a bright child, then some of the darkness that enveloped me. Hard to be bright and shiny when things are happening around you that, as a child, you don't have control over. So that's what I hope to signify by this.
Many shoes boast symbols, like dollar signs, peace icons, and bright red pairs of lips. There's a plaster pump sporting baby blue feathers, and another with a beach scene painted from arch to toe. Shalette Collie Wandrick glues multicolored beads along her shoe's sole.
My beads are falling off, and huh, that's about me. I can't be falling apart. It looks like I'm falling apart right now.
The designs on this faux footwear range from literal to extremely abstract. Still, each shoe represents a unique life path, from sharecropper to single mother.
I've been through a lot, and I'm trying to get myself back into life.
Myrtle Anderson lines her shoe with dozens of gold star stickers. The Arkansas native joined this community art project as a way to connect with others.
I had been secluded, wouldn't talk to nobody, and this and that. My daughter passed the first of the year, so I got my grandson, and I'm trying to be a role model for him.
To some, the phrase, walk a mile in my shoes, is a tired cliché. But for participant Siobhan Johnson, there's no better inspiration.
Literally, if you think about what holds us up on a real tangible level, it's our shoes that carry the weight
of our journey.
And, says Esther Osiende, these shoe-shaped self-portraits are great catalysts for a conversation.
You have women there mentoring other women and they don't even know it. But they don't feel alone, and I think that's the most important thing, that, wow, what I'm going through, I'm not by myself.
Oh, my gosh.
This is nice. This is really nice.
The finished shoes are now on display at Obsidian Arts through December 1st.
Oh, she's working hard on that shoe.
I love a sister girl that's focused.
Nikki Tundell, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
That's the NPR News Update for Wednesday. Thursday News right back here tomorrow. So long. Till then.